The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Monday, the 9th of December, 2019. On the podcast today, John Clark, Global Brand and Marcoms Officer at Gfinity, talks about them being chosen to host the NBA 2K League European Invitational and other progress. Also, Kieran Mazaria, CEO of Cadence Minerals, explains the significance of the reinstatement of the railway concessions at the Imapa iron ore project in Brazil. And also, Tony Sirichik, CEO of Salt Lake Potash, discusses how their recent institutional placing and debt facility extension will help construction at Lake Way in line with their project schedule. And as always, I have two lists for you, the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is John Clark, Global Brand and Marcoms Officer at Gfinity. G-F-I-N is the ticker there. John, thanks for joining me.
Morning, Justin.
Yeah, we had some decent news out last week, and we'll dig into that in a bit. We've got quite a few questions for you to get through. Before we get into these questions, John, for people maybe not familiar with Gfinity, could you summarise what the business is about, please?
Yes, Gfinity is the only UK-listed gaming company out there. We are focused on competitive gaming, which means that we connect game publishers, sports rights holders, brands and medias with a hard-to-reach gaming community through a number of different ways, through competitions, through great content, through community, and it's one of the fastest growing spaces anywhere in the world.
Yeah, well, exactly. Tell us what's happening with you. I mean, you mentioned the word community there. It seems like it is a community. You've got a community. Explain why this is so important and what's happening with your gaming community there.
Yeah, we've invested heavily in our understanding of the young gamer, and we've brought in a team of really talented young writers and videographers that have been able to deliver content through gfinityesports.com and realsport101.com that's really resonating. And it's grown our organic reach from under 7 million gamers per month in April this year to nearly 35 million in November. So it's growing fast. And the reason for this, you know, the gamer's notoriously hard to reach, but when you tap into their motivations and need and serve them great content, we see that they come back in their millions and keep coming back. And I think when you look at that, the reason why is that gamers love to compete and they love to learn how to get better and give them a competitive edge, which is why when we look at our Call of Duty, FIFA 20, Pro Evolution Soccer communities in particular are growing so fast, because when it comes down to it, we're basically giving them content that helps them to win. And I think that's why our numbers are closing in on 40 million by the end of this year, and we expect them to get to 100 million in the next 12 months.
Wow, they are big numbers. Now, like I said, they are big numbers, and they are mind-boggling. You know, gaming community is huge. But how are you getting sort of commercial value from these numbers, you know, connecting with the content?
Yeah, I think when you look at that, we're driving significant revenue from serving ads on the site and site takeovers, which means having brands and sports rights holders the opportunity to build interesting campaigns on the site. And increasingly, we're contacted by media companies who want access to inventory on high traffic gaming sites. Mm-hmm. And again, the reason for this is because young gamers are hard to reach. They're affluent, they're highly engaged in what they're passionate about. And brands and sports rights holders and game publishers want to reach them. And that's why they're turning to Gfinity Esports and RealSport 101 as a great channel to use. You know, Codemasters partnered with RealSport 101 Watch to launch his latest grid game. We've got youth brands like PlayStation and Google, regular advertisers, and media companies that focus solely on gaming. You know, companies like Bidstack that are increasingly turning to Gfinity to explore ways we can work together. So we're seeing significant revenue growth opportunities which go hand in hand with the number of gamers that we're reaching. And I think really we've only scratched the surface of what's possible.
Yeah, well, that's interesting because it is growing. You've done some excellent growth in the numbers there, but how do you continue to grow this, you know, in 2020 and beyond?
Yeah, because I think when you look at that, our goal is we're setting our targets high. We want to reach 100 million gamers organically in 2020, and we know when we do that, we can drive significant revenue opportunities that puts in a position of strength with publishers and brands in particular, because they want access to our gamers. The reason for this is that we've got momentum with Real Sport 101 and Gfinity Esports. They're becoming like must-visit destinations in many ways, which gives us the opportunity to go to the next stage, which means delivering the great content in multiple languages, the gamification of the sites and rewarding gamers to register, and ultimately get into grassroots gameplay on the Gfinity tech platform, which many years ago we were offering. We stopped doing that for a period of time. But as we look forward, that's definitely back in our future now that we have so many people and so many young gamers connecting with us and coming back to us on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. If you go to Latin America is a good example, is the largest region for football games. So we're going to start serving our FIFA, PES and Football Manager content in Spanish next year, which will overnight transform our reach. And then we know with our proprietary tech platform, it allows us to spin up tournaments on scale and impact in a low-cost way almost immediately. So that gives us the opportunity to offer gamers what they're looking for. So the good news for Gfinity is that we're one of the fastest growing gamer-specific communities out there. We've got momentum, and ultimately that's going to prove to be very valuable from a commercialization standpoint.
Yeah, and you're working with a number of sports rights holders. Can you, this is quite obvious really, but can you explain why they're so interested in esports and competitive gaming?
Well, there's a very simple reason here, and that's because they've got an aging fan base. Mm. And if you when that situation, you've got to look to future-proof your asset. So these sports rights holders want to attract young people, and connecting them through gaming competition and content is the way they have to go to do it. Because when you look at the research around the young gamer, all roads lead to gaming. The reason being for this is that the young people, they've chosen immersive entertainment over passive entertainment. They don't watch football or motorsport in the TV in the same way as did 2 or 3 years ago, or even a year ago. It's changing very, very quickly. I don't know if you watch some of the Amazon sort of presentation of football last week. They're near enough goals as they go in, sort of highlights and packages, rather than watching 90 minutes. So the smart sports rights holders now are saying, how do I make myself relevant to their world rather than expecting them to change their habits and engage in old ways with mine? And I think that's why the esports series that Gfinity designed, developed and delivered for Formula One is so groundbreaking, because F1 realized that gaming is going to be an important touch point for young consumers and the F1 brand. The average age of someone who attends a Formula One race or watches it on TV is over 50, but the average age of the F1 esports fan is way younger. More than 70% now are under the age of 34. And that's really what you call future-proofing your franchise. And I think the Premier League is doing exactly the same thing with the EPL, which is basically the gaming competition they launched last year. It's gone into the second year of the program, and Gfinity is delivering that for them. But last year in the final was between Man United and Liverpool, so some things don't change there from the real world to the virtual world. Hosted live from the Gfinity Arena on Sky, and a host of other sort of social Twitch and social channels. And more people watch that than watch most live Premier League matches. So, and I think when you look at that, this isn't lost on the larger teams with global fan bases. And I think pretty soon you're going to see them using gaming to engage with fans and new fans using games other than football. So if you want to future-proof your sports franchise, then all roads lead to young consumers and gaming.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very interesting how, almost the esports communities are, and crowds are bigger or as big as the real sports themselves. But so what's the exactly. next? Yeah, what's the next big sort of growth area then in esports, John?
Well, I think the next explosion is going to come through grassroots competition activity and competitive gaming entertainment. And the reason for this is that publishers are looking to expand their reach of games and bring in more fans who like to compete but don't necessarily aspire to be professionals. Not everybody wants to be a professional. But even if you take a real world example, that doesn't mean you'd love to be a professional footballer, but it doesn't stop you playing with your mates on a Sunday league or a Saturday league. And I think what publishers are looking for is saying that they recognize that lots of people are interested in following the professional teams and the professional franchises that are going out there. But how do we get more people engaged in our games, playing on a regular basis, but in a competitive way? And the other point there is, I think you're seeing big big brands are looking to find an entry point into gaming that goes beyond badging a professional tournament or an event. And once the big brands come in, their skills are in the area of storytelling and creating entertaining and entertainment-based propositions. You know, an example of that was Amazon that hired Gfinity earlier on this year to support the launch of Amazon Prime Day. We delivered a FIFA-based five-hour entertainment show at our arena, Gfinity Arena, featuring 16 celebrities, Robbie Williams, Rio Ferdinand, Alex Scott, a number of gaming influencers. But the actual gameplay was most probably less than 50% of the show. The rest was the banter and the interaction between the participants and the entertainment factor. And the viewing numbers on Twitch on that were off the charts. So competitive gaming is already mainstream. And through sort of grassroots explosion and more entertainment-based concepts, it's only going to get bigger.
Yeah, absolutely. And the figures are sort of impressive now and mind-boggling at the moment. Okay, so, John, one final thing, or should I say three final things. If someone's listening right now, likes the sound of what you're doing here at Gfinity, but are not yet following the story, could you give them three quick reasons why they should hit their follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please?
Definitely. Gfinity is the only UK listed gaming company with the fastest growing sector, with great relationships and people, and a very, very fast growing community that we're going to commercialise.
Excellent stuff, John. Good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll catch up in the not too distant future. Thank you very much.
Lovely. Thanks, Justin. Thanks for your time. Bye-bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Kieran Mazaria, CEO of Cadence Minerals. That's KDNC ticker. Kieran, thanks for joining me.
It's a pleasure speaking to you again, Justin.
Now, you've got a big bit of news out here, reinstatement of railway concessions at Amapa, and we'll unfold that and explain what it's all about in a bit. As always, okay, Kieran, for an equal to Cadence then. That's quite good there, so naming you after the company. But as always, if someone's not familiar with Cadence Minerals, could you just summarise what it's all about, please?
Yeah, absolutely. So Cadence is an investment company. We have investments across lithium projects and iron ore projects. And our latest investment that we're working on really hard for the last few months is the Amapa iron ore, the world-class Amapa iron ore project in Brazil, formerly owned by Anglo. So That's what we're focusing on at the moment, and that's who we are right now.
Yeah, and we'll touch on the potential that could come here your way with this project, because it's quite a biggie. But before we do that, take us through this reinstatement of the railway concessions at Amapa. First of all, explain what that is, and then why it's significant, if you could, Kieran.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Amapa project is an integrated iron ore project, which is about the mine, the railway, and the port. Now, one of our conditions of precedent for our investment, which was mitigating our risk, was to get the railway concession. The railway concession from the government is 180 kilometres of rail, which will allow us to ship the iron ore, roughly 5.5 million tonnes per annum, from the mine to the port. The port is owned by the mine as well, and the railway is now will be operated by the subsidiary company. Why is that important? Why is it critical? Well, if you know anything about bulk commodities, one of the largest cost base can be the logistics, i.e. getting it from the mine to the port. And if you own those logistics, if you own and operate those logistics, clearly you'll get it below commercial rates and you'll be able to save yourself substantial monies in terms of costs. What we'll have to do to this project is we're going to have to upgrade the assets and renovate the railway and the port. But to us, this is an excellent footstep, getting our way towards production at the mine, and utilising that infrastructure and saving us substantial amounts of money.
Yeah, absolutely. It's giving you sort of a more clear line of sight, I suppose. So, just for people not aware of the potential here, take us through some of the figures and the production values and amounts you're hoping to achieve.
Yeah, so let's look at some highlights. So, and it's really easy verifiable. So it was owned by Anglo American in 2000, before its sale in 2012. They valued their 70% stake on their books at $462 million. So at 100%, that would have been about $600 million of that they valued on their books. It is effectively a 14-year life of mine project with 251 million tons of resource. It has a plant, it has the railway, it has ports all being owned or operated by the company. And when it was at operations, the JR, when we published the JRP, the subsidiary company believed that EBITDA of that project would be around $136 per million dollars per annum. And average net revenue after shipping costs would be about $266 million per annum. So it has an excellent EBITDA if we'd be able to achieve the targets of around 5.3 million tons per annum of iron ore. It's got a really good set of figures in terms of being able to deliver value to the shareholders and us as investors.
Yeah, big numbers. And take us through, obviously, you've achieved this milestone now. Take us through the timeline of events. What's next, hopefully?
Well, what we've got next are we've got to get the bank. So one of this is a recovery process. So we have to get get the bank's position renegotiated. So we get a settlement with them. They release their security, and that means all the preconditions are met for our initial investment. Then we'll get our environmental licenses all granted, so hopefully during the first quarter of next year. During that period, between now and then, the idea will be to start shipping iron ore from the iron ore stockpiles. There's about 1.4 million tons of iron ore currently sitting in the port, which generates revenue for reinvestment in the project. We look to start and complete our studies during the first half of next year, which is a bankable feasibility study, and with then financing construction 1.5 years. So we'd be looking to, in 2022, being the first new ore mined from the asset in that time. But in the interim period of time, over those 2 years or 1.5 years, we'll be generating revenue from the iron ore stockpiles that are currently at port.
Yeah, and that then will obviously help with funding, won't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. So the majority of the funding is going to clearly come from it's going to come from debt financing into the project, which we will secure after we finish the bankable feasibility study. And that's quite, let's really understand this. Often when you get to bankable feasibility study, a lot of new projects, there's a lot of risk associated. There's execution risk, there's construction risk, permitting risk. We're going to be presenting banks with a project where all the environmental and operating licenses have been granted. We will have a very clear plan, and we'll already have the infrastructure that just needs to be upgraded and rehabilitated, undoubtedly. And for that, for a bank, is a much more secure proposition than not having any of that and not having the licenses. So we'll have all of that thing. So we believe that the financing risk will be mitigated, and the majority of our financing for the project will come from debt financing at the project level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because like I said, you're not starting from scratch here. It's you're restarting it, aren't you?
Yeah, it is. I mean, look, we make no bones. It's not a cheap process. I mean, I think there was about 100 and the overall CapEx cost estimated in that JRP was $168 million. A large portion of that is going to go on to the port, which had a collapse. So it's not just, $5 million, let's get it operating. I mean, this is a big project. This is 5.5 million tons a year of iron ore. It's not a small iron ore project. And, you're talking, as I said beforehand, $266 million of revenue after shipping per annum, EBITDA of $136 million per annum. It's a big project. I mean, the overall map of state said, it will affect about 7,000 people in terms of, we won't be employing 7,000, but the overall effect economically in the state will be about 7,000 people. And importantly, it represents a very large proportion of tax revenues in the state as well. So that's why we have had such success with the government. They're really vested to get this project going.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, all right. And in summary then, Kieran, if someone's listening right now, likes the sound of the potential here, but are not yet following the story, just give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please.
Three simple reasons are the MAPA project is an excellent iron ore project, world class, and it's got a very short timeline to development. The second reason, the MAPA project has had historically some great results in terms of EBITDA and profitability. The current JRP forecast of the EBITDA was 136 million per annum. And on top of that, we have also another set of diversified assets, which are also progressing well through the advanced stages of development hopefully construction in the next couple of years into revenue.
Marvelous stuff, Kieran. Good to chat to you. Hopefully we'll be catching up in the not too distant future. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Tony Sirichik, Chief Executive Officer of Salt Lake Potash. SO4 is the ticker there. Tony, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me again, Justin.
Now, I pretty much guarantee the weather is probably better where you are than where we are.
Beautiful sunny Australia. I think it's 15 degrees overnight and 30 degrees during the day. Wonderful time of year.
Well, do you know what? I was woken up several times by wind and rain over here. So literally the house is shaky. That's how we've got a storm going over us. So it's not nice here. But anyway, let's move on here. You've done an institutional placement and you've got a debt facility extension. We'll dig into that and explain what it's all about. But as always, Tony, if someone's listening for the first time, never heard about Salt Lake Potash, could you just explain the company, please?
Sure. So we're a fast-developing sulfate of potash producer here in Western Australia. We've got a very large portfolio exposure just north of Kalgoorlie in Western Australia in the goldfields. And one of the unique, you know, advantages of this company is it actually contains nine separate lakes or separate mine sites, if you like, which is very supportive of a provincial development program, which is fundamental to our five-year vision of developing sort of three mines in that five-year window and moving into being one of the largest sort of fertilizer suppliers of potash in the world, effectively. At the moment, we're fast developing Lake Way, our first project in that portfolio. And the last 12 months has seen us rapidly progress, exceeding even my most ambitious expectations, and hence the fundraising we've just done to support this fast-moving project.
Yeah, exactly. And just give us, an overline of the bankable feasibility study, the figures basically, so people can get an angle on the size of the first project.
Yes, so the first project, Lake Way, the bankable feasibility study we released in October behind us, and a very, very fantastic set of numbers, sort of 479 million Aussie dollar NPV post-tax, IRR post-tax of 28%, and just over 3 years to pay back. So a very financially attractive project being our first one in Lake Way.
Yeah, okay, marvellous stuff. So take us through this placing this debt facility. What's all this about?
So, look, the project in that BFS, you know, it had an Aussie $254 million capex piece to get this sulfate of potash project up and running. Very, very fast timetable. We want to be commissioning this time next year, so December 2020. To put it in perspective, this calendar year we've already expended about $70 million, pushing this project along at a rapid rate of knots. And what that's done, I suppose, and even after the bankable feasibility study, it's attracted an enormous number of interest from funders and players that sort of weren't, at that starting line earlier in the year, pre-BFS. So what we now are faced with is quite a lot of financing options. And we really, to do shareholders, justice and put a piece together that is best for SO4 shareholders, we want to buy that runway ahead of us sort of out into that end of March quarter next year. And what we've done effectively is gone out to the market and we've managed to place 23.5 million Aussie dollars. With our existing substantial shareholders, they've taken pro rata and above, and we've also attracted a large number of tier one top rated Aussie institutions as well into that equity placement.
Yeah. So that's a good move now. And so, what's next? What's the next big milestone here then?
So alongside that 23.5 million equity, with existing institutions and shareholders and new Aussie institutions as well, we've also had discussions with Taurus Funds Management, which is our debt lender that has been in a relationship with us since very early this year and supporting us even pre-scoping study. So they advanced us a 30 million US facility back then in the first half of this year. And they have agreed to advance a further $15 million US into that facility. So we actually have access to $45 million US dollars in this stage one debt facility. Now, we've already drawn some of that, but what was headlined last week was the $23.5 million Aussie dollar equity and the $22 million Aussie, or $15 million US advanced debt. So we've got ourselves another $45.5 million Aussie dollars, and sitting alongside the $21 million cash we had at the end of September, it's a fantastic bank balance to have to be pushing this project along at the rate of knots we are.
Yeah. And like I said, news-wise, though, you know, operationally, what's the next milestone you're hoping to achieve here then, Tony?
So for those who have been following, we've staged the civil works in this build project, and we're up to stage two of three stages in the civil project. We're flying through that. We expect to be finished stage two civils around February next year, which is a lion's share of the project requirement for the large build in that civil space. We also are planning to commence process plant off-lake construction in February next year. So, you know, the completion of stage two civils, the commencement of the process plant construction, they would be the next large milestones.
Excellent stuff. Marvellous. Yeah, it's going very well, this. And looking at the chart, it's a bit of consolidation, but it's moved really well this year. But you must be very pleased with how it's progressing, Tony.
Yeah, look, I mean, the share price is it's moving up and it's moving forward, you know, as this project develops. And, you know, we've spent a lot of money. We've moved at a rapid rate of knots, and we still are. We're constructing on site. It's real. As I say, the train has left the station. You know, we are fast moving and shaping up and de-risking this schedule to deliver potash and premium potash at that into the fertiliser market at the end of next year.
Good stuff. Okay, as always, Tony, three reasons then, if someone's listening right now and likes the sound of this but are not yet following the story, three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please.
Love this question. So I use the three T's. And the first T, Justin, is thematics. Believers out there are, you know, of a growing population and growing middle class and growing wealth, which we know changes diets, then the thematic around this sort of need for high premium, you know, quality fertilizer to achieve those high yields out there in all countries around the world that need to feed people. It's a very powerful thematic. So that's number one. Number two T is technicals. Everything from the infrastructure that's supporting Lake Way development. We've got gas lines and highways and airstrips all smothered around us that we're shamelessly using to reduce our capex. And also the reserve resource of the ore body, the quality that we've achieved from all the testing and all the financials, technicals that I rattled off earlier. So the second T is technicals. They're overwhelming, outstanding. And the third T is the team. So I think I'm going to be biased in my opinion here, but I think we would be second to no company in the world at a market cap of our size with the quality of team that I have here. So, you know, they've come from all ranges of background, a lot of ex-Fortescue and then Woolley, Parsons, Adani, they're well-known names in Australia. This team that we've amassed here has hundreds and hundreds, if not 1,000-plus years of construction and commissioning experience. So the team in place to deliver is outstanding. They're the three T's: thematics, technical, and team.
Marvellous stuff. Tony, good to chat to you. Hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
As always, Justin, appreciate it.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five. It's Integumin. That's S-K-I-N. Skin is ticker there. Of course, they've done a fundraise at 1.5 pence. At four, Open Orphan. Down at the moment. Good chat with Cahill there, though. Confident. You know, they and Haviva will be profitable this time next year. Open Orphan, ORPH ticker there. Down 12.5% at 5 pence, just over 5 pence. At three, Oracle Power. Up 16.8%. At 0.625 pence, ORCP is together. At two, Tello Oil, wow, down 63% to 51.95 pence. That's a big drop there. Number one most followed is Parity Group, up 11.989%, 10.35 pence. Of course, I covered those in the weekend video there. I do see some value being created there. You know, huge revenues, and they're improving their margins, which of course will feed the bottom line. And they're valued at what, 10 million market cap, 80 million revenue, 5 million cash in the bank. and they're going through a transformational program with their CEO. PTY is ticker there. All right, top five most liked RNSs, and most read, of course. At five, it is Zenith Energy, proposed acquisition of Norwegian subsidiary. At four, Integument, placing and subscription to raise 1.368 million. At two, well, three it is, AIM Restoration, United Oil and Gas. At two, Open Orphan, recommended all equity offer. Of course, chat that Mikhail. And number one, most liked RNS, is United Oil and Gas, Rockhopper acquisition and conditional fundraise. Hopefully, we'll get Brian on the podcast as soon as we can. Chat about that. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.